Well, I remember being on three. Is that correct? I've already finished two. In three, we are looking at the four biggies, the four important atoms that all organisms have more abundantly than any other element. And we're also looking at the valences here. We've talked about valence before, but what is the valence? No, that's one use of the word valence, but what you described is the number of valence electrons, which is not the same thing as the valence.
The number of electrons.
Yes, and the why the stability? Right, so the valence is the number of additional electrons that type of atom can hold in its valence shell. In other words, how many more need to be added to fill the outer shell in that atom or subshell. And so that's why the valence is one for hydrogen, right? Because that first shell, which is the valence shell for hydrogen, it's the only shell that has any electrons in it, so it's the only shell we consider. That first shell has how many total orbitals?
One
orbital, right, because the 1s orbital is really the same thing as the s subshell of the first level, which is really the same thing as the entire level. They're all different names for the same space in the case of level 1. And therefore, the maximum electrons that level 1 can hold is what? Right. 2, because 2 is the maximum that any orbital can hold. That's why hydrogen becomes more stable if it takes on an additional electron. That'll make it like helium. Right? Oxygen is in, or has a valence shell of number 2, right? The second shell is its valence shell. But that's made up of how many orbitals? Okay, you are not at all prepared for the exam if you can't answer these like that, because this is stuff we've covered exhaustively. And you cannot put off studying for these exams. You can't listen to all these recordings in one night and hope to pass. So, this is not looking good, unless you're just afraid to answer. So, how many orbitals are in shell 2? Yes, what are they? Well, that's 2.
Well, there's 1s.
Yes, I hesitate to say 1s, meaning a single s. Because 1s, as the numeral 1s refers to the s that's in shell 1. So the four orbitals that are in shell 2 are the 2s orbital, there's one of those, and three different 2p orbitals, 2px, 2py, 2pz. Total of four orbitals in the shell, though, each of which, like any orbital, can hold a maximum of two electrons, which is why that entire shell for shell 2 holds 8. 8 is the magic number for shell 2, not 2 like it is for shell 1. All right, well, when you look at oxygen, its valence is 6, its total number of electrons is 8. Its valence electron number is 6. It has 6 valence electrons, because we don't count those non-valence electrons that are in the deeper shell, shell 1, sorry. But its valence is 2 because 6 is 2 away from 8 being full. You can easily tell that, though, by looking at this periodic table. It's 2 steps away from the right edge. Just like hydrogen is 1 step away from the right edge. Right? It doesn't have all the, you know, this big space is really just 1 step for hydrogen, because there's only 2 in the entire period. Oxygen is 2 steps away from the right edge, which is where that stability is. so its valence is 2. And nitrogen has a valence of 3. Now, these symbols on the bottom, you actually should already know about because you've been through the lab this week. What are those called? Right, they are Lewis dot diagrams or electron dot diagrams. And the proper way to do this, to write any Lewis dot diagram, is to start by representing the nucleus with the nucleus of the atom with the chemical symbol for that type of atom, which is why for hydrogen you start with an H, right? And we've talked about this before, but just remember that on Lewis dot diagrams you are only ever portraying electrons with dots for valence electrons. You don't put all the electrons necessarily. In the case of hydrogen, yes, it's all of its electrons. But in the case of oxygen, no, it's not. There's only 6 dots here because there are 6 valence electrons. The other 2 are shielded. They're not going to take part in sharing because they're deeper in there. The outer electrons are the ones that get shared with other nearby atoms if they come into contact. That's how chemistry happens. That's why the valence electrons are so important compared to the non-valence electrons when we talk about chemical reactions. So anyway, nitrogen has a valence of 3, and carbon has a valence of 4. You can say that in one word by saying that carbon has tetravalence, or as an adjective, carbon is tetravalent. Just literally means a valence of 4. Tetra means 4. And that's kind of special compared to these other valences shown here. Carbon is in that same period as oxygen and nitrogen, meaning that its valence shell is 2, as you can see in this figure on the slide. But having a valence of 4 means it's really halfway between left edge and the right edge. And a valence of 4 provides more possibilities for carbon than for these other elements that we're seeing here. What, by the way, is the thing that all 4 of these have in common, these elements? Right, they are all nonmetals. Even though hydrogen's way over there on the left, it is considered a nonmetal. The other nonmetals are in that triangle just to the left of the noble gases. And so, what do you know about nonmetals getting together with nonmetals? Yes, covalent bonds, which is one of the 2 major kinds of chemical bonds we talked about, are formed between nonmetals, which is different from ionic bonds, right? An ionic bond always forms between a metal and a nonmetal, which means that ionic bonds have to form compounds. Covalent bonds don't have to form compounds because it doesn't have to be 2 different nonmetals. It just has to be 2 nonmetals sharing their electrons, which is why an oxygen molecule forms. It's still pure oxygen, but it's a molecule of oxygen versus 1 atom of oxygen. You can't have that with a covalent bond because one of them has to be different from the other if one's a metal and the other one's a nonmetal. Okay? So that's true in general for covalent bonds. They can form compounds or not. But anyway, what do we call the structures that are the overall structures that are formed if there's covalent bonds? If covalent bonds form, what is the overall structure that's created? Not necessarily. That's what I was just talking about. It doesn't have to be a compound. It is if the 2 nonmetals that bind together are different nonmetals, but they don't have to be. But in general, whether it's a compound or an element that is created when covalent bonds form, what is the overall structure called? A molecule, exactly. That word applies to covalently bonded substances, not to salts. Salts are ionic compounds. Well, anyway, back to the valence. A practical way of thinking about the valence that we talked about in lab when we were using the kits is that the valence of an atom is how many total covalent bonds that atom needs to make if it is going to be a member of a molecule. In every molecule, the reason that it forms is that every atom becomes satisfied valence-wise, which means every time oxygen is part of a molecule, whatever molecule it is, not just water, anything that oxygen is a member of the molecule in, it's going to be making two total bonds, either two single bonds or one double bond, which counts as two. Nitrogen's always going to be making three bonds. And every nitrogen, however many nitrogens are in that molecule, will be making three total bonds. Well, carbon is special because of this tetravalence. It has to make four bonds because its valence is four. And this is what I meant when I earlier said that there's more possibilities for carbon than for other nonmetals. All right, this tetravalence is special because there's a lot of different ways you can satisfy the valence of carbon, since it's a valence of four. Just in general, without even talking about specific nonmetals that it binds with, there's already variety because you can make either four single bonds if you're a carbon, you can make two double bonds, or you can make a triple bond and a single bond. Any of those adds up to four. Right? So that's variety already compared to the other ones. But then when you get down to specific atoms that it's bonding with, if you're going to make four individual bonds, four single bonds, you can make it with four of the same thing, or four of the same thing but a different one, or two of one thing and two other different ones. Right? Four totally different things, all of which have just single bonds, and then there's more variety when you talk about two double bonds, and so on. So there's all kinds of possible ways in which carbon can bind with other nonmetals, because carbon and carbon can bind as well, of course. And that's why there are so many molecules, which remember are covalent structures, nonmetals involved, so many molecules involve carbon because of this tetravalence, which is why the immense science called chemistry has two huge subdivisions. Organic chemistry, which is concerned with all of these millions of compounds that have carbon in them, and inorganic chemistry, everything else. But by looking at the periodic table, what is an example of something else that has tetravalence? How would you know what else on the periodic table has tetravalence? Right. So, in other words, anything in that same group. Remember, the groups are the columns. So carbon is not unique in its tetravalence. It's not the only tetravalent element. But without overthinking this, if you look at that group that contains carbon, what is special about carbon on that list? Well, if I were to ask a little kid, well, yeah, a little kid would say that, true. And that is true, but if carbon happened to be also two letters, so ignore that. What else is special about it in that list? It's at the top, yes. Yes, which means it's small. It's the smallest element, because this is an ordering of size, right, by atomic number. So it's the smallest element that has tetravalence. And smallest not only is special in itself, but because of that smallness means it's more common in the universe than other tetravalent atoms. These things become less and less common as they get bigger and bigger. All right, so that's the real specialness of carbon. Its versatility with respect to forming molecules because of its tetravalence and the fact that it's the smallest tetravalent atom. All right, let's go to 4. This is urea, or the structural formula for urea, as you see. And there's really nothing special about urea as far as this chapter is concerned, other than a historical note. It's an organic compound. You can see that it's carbon bonded with other things. Urea is a waste product that's produced in your body if protein is used as fuel, which it usually isn't. You usually use sugars as fuel or fats. But protein can be used for fuel, and if it is, it will cause urea to have to be made because it's a waste product. It's part of urine. But the historical importance of urea is that it was the first successfully synthesized organic compound. Remember in an earlier episode, I told you that we named organic compounds organic because we thought they came only from organisms, and that there was something fundamentally different between the stuff organisms are made out of compared to non-living things. And we thought that because for a long time no one was ever successful in making an organic compound starting with stuff that didn't come from an organism to begin with. In other words, using inorganic stuff to produce organic stuff. No one had done that. Now, it's routine nowadays. We could do it all the time. But urea was the first successful attempt at that, starting out with inorganic stuff and just using pure chemistry to form it. Okay, let's take a closer look at some organic compounds. In slide 5, I hope you agree that these are all organic, right? In each of them, of course, there's carbon, which is a requirement for being organic, but it's necessary but not sufficient, right? Having carbon is not enough. You have to have carbon and something else to be organic, with a couple exceptions. Like I said, CO2 is not considered organic, even though it has carbon and something else. But almost everything else that has carbon and something else in it is organic. So these are all organic. But what else do you notice about these? More specifically than saying they're organic, what can we say? What do they all have in common? Hydrogen is the only other thing besides carbon in these, yes. Every one of these is an example of a molecule made up only of carbon and hydrogen, no other element. And so that's just a subset of the bigger set that we call organic compounds, right? Organic is carbon and other things. Well, a smaller set of that set is carbon and hydrogen and nothing else. What do we call those collectively? Hydrocarbons, exactly. Now, I mentioned that word last lecture, I believe. Hydrocarbon and carbohydrate, don't confuse. Hydrocarbons means hydrogen and carbon only, nothing else. And even though that's only some of the millions of possible, really there's no limit, of possible organic compounds, hydrocarbons just by themselves there's really no limit to, because of how many ways carbons and hydrogens can be combined, and especially because there's no limit to how many of these atoms you can use. Okay, so all of the carbons in each of these examples is highlighted in teal. And whatever is highlighted here is called the carbon skeleton. The carbon skeleton of a hydrocarbon is simply all of the carbons. All right? And notice that that number can change. So the A, B, and C, and D of this slide indicate four fundamentally different ways in which we can categorize or classify hydrocarbons. Because there are so many, we want to put them into categories just to make things neater. And so one way that we can classify hydrocarbons is based on length. Length meaning the size of the carbon skeleton, how many carbons there are. All right, ethane and propane are just two of endless examples. The simplest possible hydrocarbon would be what? Methane, exactly. The simplest possible way that you can have a hydrocarbon is to have only one carbon, right? And the only way, using nothing but hydrogens, which has to be the only other thing in a hydrocarbon, to satisfy the valence, is to have all four of those bonds be formed by hydrogen. So a carbon and four hydrogens is methane. We've looked at that before, and I think you built it with a ball and a stick. Well, methane, ethane, propane, those all have the same endings, notice. But the prefix, meth means one, carbon, eth means two, prop means three, bute means four, so butane, and then pentane for five, hexane for six, heptane for seven, octane for eight, and so on. That's one way to classify hydrocarbons, based on chain length or carbon skeleton size. B shows you that you can also classify hydrocarbons based on whether or not there is branching in the carbon skeleton. Now, there's no branching possible for one carbon, or for two, or for three. But as soon as you get four or more, you could either have it linear, no branching, or you can have branching. And as the number of carbons gets bigger and bigger, you can have multiple branching, and there's just so many different ways that you can branch these things that you have a lot of possibilities. So branching or non-branching, that's another way of categorizing them. And by the way, butane and 2-methylpropane that are shown here brings up an important point about hydrocarbons, which are that there's a lot of possible isomers. Now, did we talk about isotopes? Or did I actually talk about it in lecture? I don't remember whether I did. I mention it now because I don't want you to confuse isotope with isomer. And isotopes are two versions of the same element. Remember that we talked about what makes a given atom one element versus another, and the only thing that matters is the number of protons, right? So every hydrogen atom has to, in order to be hydrogen, has to have exactly one proton. But most hydrogen atoms don't have a neutron. They just have that proton, and that's it for the nucleus. Some of them, in addition to having the proton that's required, also has a neutron. So there's two versions of hydrogen. They're both hydrogen, but they are isotopes of each other. Iso means same. Okay? One of them has a bigger mass, though, because of that neutron, than the other. And some of them have multiple possible, some elements have multiple possible isotopes. That's what an isotope is. Different versions of an element that differ in their number of neutrons. Well, here what I'm talking about on this slide is totally different. Still has that iso prefix, meaning same, but an isomer, or isomers, are different versions, they're different substances that have exactly the same number and kinds of atoms. In other words, isomers are different substances that have exactly the same chemical formula, which is why when you write a chemical formula, sometimes it doesn't really tell you exactly what stuff you have. because there can be multiple different substances with exactly that same chemical formula. Butane, notice, is C4H10, but so is 2-methylpropane. They have different properties because they are different substances, but they have exactly the same chemical formula. Those are isomers. C tells you that we can also classify hydrocarbons based on whether or not there are double bonds in the carbon skeleton. Now, in the upper left, ethane and propane are examples of hydrocarbons that don't have any multiple bonds. Every bond is single. Okay? If you have hydrocarbons in which only single bonds occur, that category of chemicals is called alkanes. Alkane is not a specific substance, it's a category. There's no limit to the number of alkanes you can have, but specific alkanes get their name with an ending A-N-E to remind you that they're alkanes. So all of those alkanes I mentioned before, octane, heptane, hexane, ethane, propane, butane, those all end in A-N-E to tell you that there's nothing but a single bond, single bonds in the molecule. Well, 1-butene and 2-butene end in E-N-E. These are alkenes. Alkenes are hydrocarbons with at least one double bond. There can be more than one double bond, but there has to be at least one to make it an alkene. So that's not a substance either. That's a category, but individual examples of alkenes have names that end in E-N-E to tell you that. 1-butane is named because the double bond occurs between the first, that's the one, and the second carbon. Whereas 2-butene, the double bond occurs between carbon 2 and 3. Okay? They have different properties from each other. 1-butene and 2-butene are very similar. They're isomers, they have the same chemical formula, but they behave differently chemically because of the different placement of the double bonds. And there's actually a third category called alkynes, Y-N-E, and those are hydrocarbons that have at least one triple bond. So that's another way of classifying them. And then D shows you that we can classify hydrocarbons based on whether or not there is a ring in the carbon skeleton. A ring structure, or a cyclic hydrocarbon, as it's called, is simply that the carbon skeleton comes back and joins on itself. Now, there can be other carbons that hang off of the ring, but there has to be a ring for it to be a ring structure or a cyclic hydrocarbon. It would be an alkyne still. So it's an ene only if it has double and nothing higher.
So it's only based off of what's the highest?
Exactly. So alkanes, the highest is one, a single bond. That's a good question, by the way. Okay, so cyclohexane, benzene, those are just common examples. Anything that has a ring structure, though, is a cyclic hydrocarbon. The other ones are called acyclic hydrocarbons, or just linear hydrocarbons. Or unbranched, I guess, is another word for them. Anyway, let's go on to six. Now, one thing I didn't mention in 5 when we were looking at those hydrocarbons, though, in slide 5, those were all official hydrocarbons because there was no other kind of atom in any of those, right? That's a requirement for you for something to for a molecule to be a hydrocarbon. In 6, we're looking at a fat, and a fat is not a hydrocarbon because it has these oxygen atoms in it. But a fat is an example of a lipid. And you've already learned that lipids is one of the four categories of macromolecules. We still haven't gotten to the chapter that surveys all four of these, so we'll be taking a much closer look at all four of these categories after the exam. But lipids is one of those four, and all fats are lipids. Not all lipids are fats. There are other lipids besides fats, but all fats are lipids. And fats are, like any macromolecule, built by putting smaller pieces together. In the case of a fat, which can also be called a triglyceride, There are really four components that you have to put together to make it. One is a glycerol molecule, which is the part here on the left with the red oxygens. That would be a molecule by itself until you start adding to it. And then these three tails, each one is called a fatty acid. And so when you hook three fatty acids individually onto the same glycerol molecule, you have what is called a triglyceride or a fat. Well, you don't really see it in this detail, and we'll look at it later, but a fatty acid by itself is a molecule, except when it's not attached, the fatty acid has an oxygen on the end. And so a fatty acid is not actually a hydrocarbon because it has that oxygen in it. But if you look at the rest of the tail, that's nothing but carbons and hydrogens. So it's almost a hydrocarbon. And it has a lot of the properties that hydrocarbons have because it's almost entirely hydrocarbon. Well, one of the important properties of hydrocarbons in general is that they make excellent fuels, because there is a lot of chemical energy stored in the form of carbon-carbon and carbon-hydrogen bonds. All right? And we'll be talking a lot about that in Unit 3, which is all about energy. But they make excellent fuels, whether for organisms, in the bodies of the organisms, or in industry. You know, gasoline, which is a fuel for internal combustion engines, is really just a mixture of a bunch of hydrocarbons, a bunch of alkanes. You'll see an octane rating on the gas pump. Well, octane is just one of the components. There's decane and nonane and heptane all mixed in there as well. They all are hydrocarbons, though, so they all have a bunch of carbon-hydrogen bonds, which if the fuel gets burned, reacted with oxygen, will release a lot of energy. That's true for gasoline powering a vehicle, but it's also true for things that are almost hydrocarbons, though not technically hydrocarbons, that have a lot of carbon-hydrogen bonds in them. Those make excellent fuels for organisms. And so fats and monosaccharides, which are a type of carbohydrate, have a bunch of these carbon-hydrogen bonds. Fat is shown here because of its importance as a fuel. There's other really important uses of fat as well, but we'll get into that when we survey the macromolecule types. All right, let's go to 7. I've talked a little bit already about isomers. I've given you the definition. Well, there are many different kinds of isomers. I don't mean examples of isomers. I mean there are different categories of isomers, each of which has many examples in it. And there are more than just three. You would learn more than three categories of isomers if this were an organic chemistry course. But for this course, these are the three categories you need to know. As you see, they are the structural isomers, the geometric isomers, and the enantiomers. Let's look at these top to bottom. Structural isomers are pretty easy to understand. I've already really described them. Structural isomers are different substances with the same chemical formula, like any isomers are, but they are different from each other just because they are different arrangements of the carbon skeleton. So in this example, pentane is C5H12, so is 2-methylbutane. The difference is that one of them has a non-branched carbon skeleton, the other has a branched carbon skeleton. Yeah, they are isomers that differ from each other just by virtue of different arrangement of the carbon skeleton. Notice that pentane and 2-methylbutane happen to be both alkanes, right? So it's possible to have structural isomers for just alkanes, just when single bonds are involved. But it's not possible to have the next category of isomers if you are talking about alkanes, only single bonds. The next one is geometric isomers. And it helps to think about your modeling that you did in lab. When you used the ball and stick models, every individual stick you could swivel, right? You can swivel a single bond. However many bonds there are in the molecule, each one of those can be swiveled, which is why when you make, well, you made glucose, right? Well, glucose doesn't have one shape. As you saw in the model, you can twist it all kinds of different ways. It's still the same molecule. But when you use a pair of springs, which represents a double bond, you can't swivel it anymore, right? It holds those two atoms in place. And that's what's represented here with the blue X's. X, it was used here to represent anything other than hydrogen, because there's no chemical formula, I mean, no chemical symbol that's just X by itself. So X can mean anything other than hydrogen. If they were all four hydrogens, it wouldn't matter. So the point is here, you have hydrogens on one side, and you have something else on the other side. Well, because this is a double bond between the carbons, those two X's, whatever they are going to remain on that side, because you can't swivel this. Whereas on the other isomer, the X's are diagonally from each other, and they're going to stay there because you can't swivel the C's. So that gives you two possible isomers, which are the cis isomer and the trans isomer. We use those words for several different things, like in gender, right? Cisgender, transgender, and so on. Cis means same side. Trans means other side or across, like Trans Am. A Trans Am is short for Across America. Okay, so those are geometric isomers. You have to have a double bond for those to occur. And the most complex of the three categories that you have to know for this course are the enantiomers on the bottom, which are examples of stereoisomers. Stereo means solid, which means three-dimensional. They're all, of course, have three dimensions, but that's why stereoisomers were named. And there's different kinds of stereoisomers, others that you don't have to know, but enantiomers are the examples you have to know. Enantiomers are also examples of what we call chiral compounds. Chiral means handed, having handedness, which is why the hands are shown here alongside the ball and stick models. So a chiral compound is one that is either right-handed or left-handed, but there is the other hand possible as well. Consider your hands before we look at the molecules. Your two hands are very, very similar to each other, but they definitely are not the same as each other. If you were able to take them off and have someone manipulate them, like models, there's no way that you can take your right hand and turn it around in space and make it into your left hand. That's because they're mirror images of each other. They're not the same thing, right? So there's a right hand version and a left hand version. Well, if you have carbon, because of its tetravalence, forming four single bonds, which is just one way that it can satisfy its valence, right? If you have it form four single bonds, and every one of those bonds is different, every one of the things that it's connected to is different, so it's connected to four different atoms in this case. If you make that ball and stick model, there's no way that you can pick it up and turn it around and turn it into this other version, which has the same four things connected to it. Because they're mirror images of each other, the only way you can turn one into the other is to break two of the bonds, switch them, and then reform the bonds. So they are separate substances. The left-handed version is different from the right-handed version. They seem like they're identical, but they're not. And which version you have matters as to how it works. We can see an example of that in slide 8. Here we have ibuprofen and albuterol. Both ibuprofen and albuterol are exogenous signals. What's another name for an exogenous signal? A drug, yes. It's a chemical signal, so it can work in the body as a signal. But like all signals, whether it's produced inside the body or introduced into the body, a signal doesn't do anything, remember, unless and until it binds to the correctly shaped receptor that's able to receive that particular signal molecule. Drugs don't do anything unless there are receptors for them in the body. Well, ibuprofen is a chiral molecule. There's two versions of it, a left-handed and a right-handed version. But only one of them works because in the body, we only have one version of the receptor. Receptors are also chiral. So there can be a right-handed version of the receptor and a left-handed version, but the body's going to have one or the other, not both. And it depends. You can't say that the right-handed version is always the effective one or the left-handed version is always the effective one. It depends on signal-to-signal basis. In the case of ibuprofen, the effective version, the one that actually does something in the body, is the S version. Notice there's an S and an R. Well, S is the left-handed version, R is the right-handed version. And the left-handed version of ibuprofen works. If you can manufacture the right-handed version, give it to people, but it's not going to do a damn thing because the receptors in the body are all left-handed for that molecule. And it would be like putting a right hand into a left glove. It's not a good fit. By the way, the S here stands for sinistro, or as just a, that's a prefix, for a whole word, it would be sinistral. And a related word is sinister, of course, right? Well, sinister literally means left-handed. It's just one of the ways that we, right-handed majority of the world is kind of mean to the left-handed minority. Sinister means you better be leery of that person, right? But the reason the word evolved was someone said, oh, be careful, that person is left-handed. Be wary. Not fair, of course. Left-handed people don't need to be feared, but that's what sinister actually means. The R stands for recto as a prefix, which means right, like a rectangle has only right angles. Albuterol, on the other hand, the effective one, is the right-handed version. Left-handed version will do nothing. Well, 9 is really just another example of this, except it shows you that there are other ways besides S and R to denote the left and right-handed version. L-DOPA and D-DOPA are chiral molecules. They're enantiomers of each other. There's a left-handed version and a right-handed version. L stands for levo, which means left, and D stands for dextro, which means right. So dextrous, which means working well with the hands, literally means right-handed, another way that we make fun of the left-handed people of the world. And ambidextrous, which means able to use both your hands, means that person has two right hands. Unfair to the left-handers, but that's what it means. And you see L a lot in drugs. If you ever notice drug names, you see this in the future. L whatever the name is, means it's the left-handed version. L-DOPA is a signal that we make in our bodies, but you can also use it as a drug, introduce it. But if you introduce D-DOPA, it's not going to work because our dopamine receptors are left-handed. Okay, now to 10. These two signals that we see here are hormones. Estradiol is the main estrogen. There are different estrogens. Testosterone is shown on the right. And estrogen and testosterone have drastically different effects in the body, right? Estrogens are feminizing hormones. Testosterone is a masculizing hormone. So very, very different effects. Even though when you look at the structural formulae of these two, they're almost identical. They both share, they have this ring structure in common, these four rings in yellow. And that makes sense that they both have these, by the way, because these two hormones are steroid hormones, and all steroid hormones in all animals, not just us, start out as the same indispensable molecule to begin with, precursor molecule, that then gets modified to make all of the steroid hormones, including the other steroids, not just these two. So this precursor molecule that these come from is something animals cannot live without, for that reason and others. Do you know what I'm talking about? What is the molecule that can be modified just slightly to make it any of the steroid hormones and other molecules as well? Well, what nutrient do you get if you eat animals, but you don't get any if you don't eat any animals?
Protein.
Now, you get protein in both. It's called cholesterol. Cholesterol is indispensable to animals. Animals cannot live without it. Now, I mentioned that diet thing because I'm a vegan, so I don't take in any cholesterol since I don't eat any animal products. But that doesn't mean my cholesterol is zero. I would be dead if it were. The reason it's not zero is because I'm an animal. I make my own cholesterol, just like any animals that you would eat make their own cholesterol. So you make your own cholesterol, and if you eat animals, you're also taking in extra. But anyway, the cholesterol is the precursor molecule that looks almost exactly like these two, and these two just came from it by slightly modifying that cholesterol to begin with. But how the modification is done, even though it's a slight modification, really matters, which is why these have such different effects. When you look at them structurally, the only difference between these two is what's hanging off of this ring structure. The parts that are shaded in blue, in other words. And these things that are shaded in blue are examples of things that you started studying in the lab, which are called functional groups. Okay? So that shows you the importance of functional groups, and it shows you why functional groups are called functional groups. A functional group is not a molecule. It's only part of a molecule. It's a particular collection, a small collection of atoms that are just part of the overall number of atoms in the molecule, but they're arranged in a certain way so that they have a name, a specific name. There's different kinds of functional groups that we'll look at. But in general, functional groups are called functional groups because if a molecule has that functional group, it's going to give that molecule a specific function. It's going to be able to act a certain way chemically because of the existence of that functional group. And that's the big difference between these radically different hormones. Not structurally, overall, the big difference is that their functional groups are different. So as I said in lab, you have to know the functional groups I'm about to go over in these next two slides for two reasons. For the exam, you have to know them, but you also have to know them for the lab. By the time you get to the lab, you'll already done with the exam. So just realize it's for both. Now, this is not an exhaustive list of functional groups. You would learn more than these if this were an organic chemistry course, but we're going to look at several that really are on the same table in whatever book I got this from, but slide 11 and 12 look similar. They're just parts of the same table. Start in slide 11, though, and each column here is a different functional group, so you get the name at the top, but you also get two ways of looking at the structure, as a structural formula written with letters or as a ball and stick model. Now, if you look at either of these renditions, either the ball and stick model, and for any of them, not just this first one, or the chemical formula model, You can tell that they're not complete molecules, as I said before, right? Why are these not complete molecules? I mean, what makes it obvious that they're not complete molecules? Yeah. Exactly. Right, that line that's hanging off of it is a bond that's not actually completed. Meaning it has to be completed by hooking onto something. Right? That's why it's not a complete molecule. But it is hooked onto something. It just depends on which molecule it's a member of as to what that is that it's hooked onto. So that's some books will have just a dash like dash OH, showing that the rest of the molecule is whatever's at the other end of this dash. Or some books will use R at the other end of the dash, just as a general placeholder. Now, R stands, in this case, for residue, which simply means what's left over. In other words, it's the rest of the molecule, whatever it is. Okay? R doesn't specify anything. There's no chemical symbol of R, so it's why they used it. It's just whatever the rest of the molecule is. And these things can be written backwards or forward. You can write it as R-OH or HO-R. But importantly, you would not be able to write it as OH-R. What's wrong with this? That's right, and what's wrong with that? Right, hydrogen has a valence of one. It can only make one bond, or it can make only one bond. It's already making its bond with oxygen, so it can't make any more bonds. This is impossible. So, don't ever write it that way. No, they mean exactly the same thing. Okay, now hydroxyl is a pretty simple functional group. It is just an oxygen and hydrogen, and the oxygen, of course, has to make two overall bonds. That's why the oxygen is the thing that is hooked to the residue or the rest of the molecule. There's all kinds of substances that have a hydroxyl group in them. The name of the category of substances that have at least one hydroxyl in them is called alcohols. That's what it means for a substance to be an alcohol. It has at least one hydroxyl in it. Now, we tend to think about just one specific kind of alcohol when we say in everyday language alcohol. We're usually referring to the one shown here, which is ethanol. Ethanol is beverage alcohol. So whether it's beer, wine, or booze, it's exactly the same kind of alcohol. But that's one of just thousands of kinds of alcohol. Anything with a hydroxyl is an alcohol. By the way, notice how ethanol got its name. If you, instead of having OH here, you just had another hydrogen, this would be a 2-carbon alkane, which we call ethane. We saw that in a previous slide, because eth means 2. Well, ethanol means ethane-like alcohol. So not only is any substance with an OH or a hydroxyl group an ethanol, but we give names to alcohols with OL endings to remind us of that. Isopropanol is another alcohol because it ends in OL. Biologically speaking, these are important because just like in water, which has an O and an H, the hydroxyl group gives that part of the molecule polarity. Why is OH a polar bond? Which is the same reason any polar bond is polar.
Oxygen has higher electronegativity.
That's right. Because of a drastic difference in the magnitude of electronegativities, oxygen's value is much higher than hydrogen's value. So there's unequal sharing, and that means alcohols will mingle with other polar molecules pretty easily. Okay, carbonyl is the next one. And notice that it is a carbon double bonded to an oxygen. Well, that meets two of the four bonds that carbon has to make. It still has to make two other bonds, though, right? Which is why this one has two sticks hanging off of it, two unmet bonds. But it's the carbon that is connected to the residue. The oxygen's already satisfied. Because there are two other bonds that carbon has to make, there's not just one category of carbonyl-containing compounds. There are two separate categories, each of which has many examples. There's two ways in which this carbon can be incorporated into the molecule. By this carbon, I mean the carbon that's actually part of this functional group. Okay? There's a carbon skeleton in the overall molecule, because it's part of an organic molecule, so there's some number of carbons. But there's two ways that this carbonyl's carbon can be incorporated into the skeleton. One way is that carbon of the carbonyl can be on a tip of the carbon skeleton. And I say a tip because there can be many tips depending on how many branches there are, right? In a non-branching carbon skeleton, there's two tips, one end or the other. You can see this in one of the two examples within this column. This carbon in propanol, this carbon that's violet colored, is at the tip of the skeleton. But the carbon that's part of acetone, the carbon that's a carbon in part of the carbonyl group, is not at a tip. So those are the two fundamental possibilities. The carbonyl carbon is at a tip, or the carbonyl carbon is not at a tip. Well, since those are two major possibilities, we give those two categories separate names. And those names, as you see, are ketones and aldehydes. Where's my eraser? Ketones and aldehydes are not substances, just like alkanes, not a specific substance. It's a category of substances. Uh-oh. Down to only bad ones. Ketones and aldehydes. Ketones have their carbonyl carbon not at the tip. Aldehydes have their carbonyl carbon at the tip, at a tip. Well, I used to forget which one was which all the time, until one day it occurred to me that the word aldehyde starts with an A, which is at one tip of the alphabet. So you can use that. And ketone starts with a K, which is in the middle of the alphabet. It's not at a tip. So if that helps you to remember that, use it. By the way, aldehydes have names that end in A-L, which is why this is called propanol, not propanol. That would be an alcohol. And ketones have names that end in O-N-E, like acetone. Okay, now, the reason that these are important biologically is mostly because of sugars, which we'll explore in the next chapter when we look at the biological macromolecules. Sugars are either aldehydes or ketones, depending on the sugar. And sugars are really important for as energy, as fuel. Okay, carboxyl is next. Now, when you look at the ball and stick model or the structural formula, it looks like you just have one of each of the two that we just covered, right? It looks like this thing is a carbonyl that's also connected to a hydroxyl. And actually, it is. But when you have this particular arrangement, we don't consider it to be either a carbonyl or a hydroxyl. When you have them both just like this, connected together, we call the whole thing just one functional group, which is a carboxyl. It really is the combination, though, which is why the name is a combination of those two functional groups' name. Carboxyl gets its name from the fact that it's carbonyl and hydroxyl. Just don't consider it to be a carbonyl or a hydroxyl. It's its own special functional group. And the carbon has three bonds it's making, so the rest of the molecule is connected to the carbon to make the fourth bond. Now, these are indispensable biologically because the category of molecules that contain a carboxyl group, at least one carboxyl group, are called either carboxylic acids, which makes sense based on the fact that they include a carboxyl group, or they can be called organic acids. Carboxylic acids is the better word, but the reason they're called organic acids is that there's a lot of acids that are inorganic, like hydrochloric acid, HCl, doesn't have any carbon in it, so it's inorganic. Most acids are like that, actually. But ones that have carbon in them, carboxylic acids or organic acids. The reason these are indispensable for life is that every subunit in any protein, proteins are large polymers, as we'll study, but you build a polymer by hooking together a bunch of subunits called monomers. Every monomer in every polypeptide, in every protein, is a carboxylic acid. Well, these are called amino acids. Those are the subunits' names, but to be an amino acid, you have to have a carboxyl group. This acetic acid has a carboxyl group. It doesn't show one here. Any amino acid, though, would also have a carboxyl group. Okay? So you can't have proteins without carboxyl groups. It's impossible to think about life without proteins. When we continue in the table on slide 12, the next one up is the amino group. And whenever you see forms of that word, whether it's amino or amine or amino, all of those forms mean nitrogen is involved. And as you can see in the formula here, amino has a nitrogen. The amino is not just nitrogen. The amino functional group is a nitrogen singly bonded to two hydrogens. And then the third bond, which nitrogen has to make, is with the residue. Anything that includes an amino group is called an amine. So that's the category of substances. And that includes amino acids that I just mentioned. Amino acids, I just said, are the subunits of proteins. And every amino acid has a carboxyl in it, which is why carboxyls are so important to biology. But also, every amino acid has an amino group. Here you see glycine, which is the simplest possible amino acid. Notice it has a carboxyl group, like every amino acid does, but it also has an amino group. This is why we call these things amino acids. Amino from the fact that it has amino, and the acid comes from carboxylic acid. You hook a bunch of these together, whether they're the same version or different versions of amino acids, and that's how you make a protein. So that's why they're indispensable to life. The amino group. Yeah?
If you just had one or three, it's still amino, or does it have to be related?
Well, they would be called amines still. But the amino group has two H's specifically. Amines is a more general term. All right, next up is the sulfhydryl group. And which of the ones that we already learned is most similar to the sulfhydryl in structure? Sulfhydryl looks pretty much like which one? The hydroxyl. The difference, of course, is that instead of an oxygen with a hydrogen, you have a sulfur and a hydrogen. Why does it make sense to substitute a sulfur for an oxygen? Yes, and they also have the same valence.
Yeah, valence.
Yes. They're in the same group. They have similar properties. So SH can form just as easily as OH. Well, what do we call molecules that have at least one hydroxyl? What's the category name? Alcohols. Well, things that have a sulfhydryl are not alcohols because it's not OH, but notice that their name is thiols, the category. The thio part means sulfur. So there's all kinds of chemical names that have that, like thiourea, urea with sulfur in it. But notice that it's thiols, a word that linguistically means sulfur-like alcohol. I mean, alcohol-like sulfur-containing compound is really what it means. So thiols are not alcohols, but they chemically act similar to alcohols because SH is similar to OH. Right? Biologically, these are important when it comes to proteins once again. There's, as we'll talk about, there's 20 different kinds of amino acids that organisms use to build their proteins. And cysteine is one of those 20 kinds. Cysteine is shown here. Cysteine has a sulfhydryl group in it. When you have a bunch of different amino acids strung together to form a polypeptide, it doesn't remain as a linear string. It then folds up, just like a bead of strings, if you just throw it onto a table. It's not going to be a perfect line, right? It's going to fold up. And that's going to make amino acids that are in different positions on the chain come into contact with each other. If it's two cysteines, each with a sulfhydryl, those sulfhydryl groups will chemically react. They'll each lose a hydrogen, and the two sulfurs will covalently bond together. And that's really going to stabilize the shape of that protein. It's going to hold it into place because of that strong covalent bond. Proteins that have these sulfhydryl groups are very, very stable and strong. There's a lot of it in your hair, which is why if you burn hair accidentally, usually, but you could do it on purpose if you want, it smells like sulfur. There's a lot of sulfur. Okay, phosphate is next. And for the ones that you have to learn, this is the most complex in terms of the number of atoms involved. Notice that there's a phosphorus atom, which is obvious from the name, but there's four oxygen atoms connected to it, and one of those oxygen atoms is then also connected to the rest of the molecule. You find phosphates in a lot of places in organisms. It is impossible to overstate how important phosphates are to biology. There's several different reasons why none of us would exist without phosphate groups. One is that nucleic acids, which is one of the four categories of macromolecules, nucleic acids includes DNA and RNA. They're also polymers. You build them by hooking together monomers, and the monomers are called nucleotides. We'll get into that later. But every single subunit of any DNA or RNA includes phosphate in it. So you can't have any DNA or RNA, and therefore no organisms, without phosphate. You also cannot have any cells without phosphate, because, as we'll talk about later, the plasma membrane, which every cell that's ever existed has to have, it really is the boundary between the cell and everything else. It's made up of a phospholipid bilayer. It's every one of those many, many molecules that makes up the membrane has a phosphate in it. Plus, if that's not enough, phosphate can be added to molecules or taken off of those molecules. We say that we can phosphorylate a protein, for instance, like an enzyme, or dephosphorylate it. This is a way to control the protein. We can switch it on or off quickly. Right? If you need a protein at the moment, you want it to be switched on. If the next moment you don't need it, you could destroy it to keep it from continuing to work. That will stop it, of course. But if then the next moment you need it again, you'd have to go to the trouble and expense of building it again. That takes time and energy. If instead you can switch it on and off and keep it there, just only use it when it's switched on, that's much more efficient. And one way of activating or deactivating proteins is to phosphorylate them or dephosphorylate them. All of those are important functions of phosphate. Methyl is the final one. And methyls you find everywhere. If you haven't already noticed by doing the lab, when you look at structural formulae, you find methyls more than anything else. Especially in branched molecules, because every tip, of course, has a carbon at the tip. And that carbon, if it's singly bonded to the one next to the tip, that means that carbon at the tip needs to make three more bonds. And the easiest way to do that is to make three single bonds with three different hydrogens. That's what a methyl is. So you find them all over the place, but they can also be used as little switches, kind of like phosphorylation and dephosphorylation, except we call it methylation and demethylation. This is a way in which genes, DNA, can be turned on or off. Every cell in your body, except your blood, red blood cells, which don't have nuclei, all the rest of your cells not only have DNA, but they all have the same library of DNA, which means any cell has the potential to build any protein that your whole body can make. But you would never want most of your cells to make most of those proteins. You don't want fingernails growing in your kidney. You have the genes for that to happen, but they need to be turned off in places where it's not appropriate to grow fingernails. And one way to turn off genes in that part of the body for the lifetime is to methylate the DNA. All right, those are the functional groups you need to know. And slide 13 just shows you yet another. I've mentioned three major reasons why phosphate is indispensable. There's actually a fourth, and that's because it is part of the most important energy-carrying molecule in organisms, which is ATP. That is an acronym for adenosine triphosphate. So this is adenosine by itself. When you hook three phosphates onto that, you have adenosine triphosphate. It stores energy because there's a bunch of energy locked up in those phosphate-phosphate bonds. And when we use that energy to do something in the cell, when we spend the ATP, as we say, we're cleaving off one of those phosphates to get at that energy. And that turns it into adenosine diphosphate, ADP. Plus there's a phosphate group by itself, which we call an inorganic phosphate because it's no longer connected to a carbon skeleton. It's just a phosphate ion in that case. So that's important. That's the important use, another important use of phosphate. But another reason I'm giving you this slide is to make sure you don't misinterpret symbols. P by itself does not mean phosphate. P by itself means a phosphorus atom, because P is the chemical symbol for phosphorus. But when you have P with a circle around it, that is just standard shorthand for an entire phosphate group. Yes, the phosphorus atom is there, but so are the four oxygen atoms. It's just, you don't bother. The circle is an easier way than drawing all the oxygens. That's the difference. All right. So the I subscript after the P circle means inorganic phosphate, a phosphate group that is no longer part of a bigger molecule. It's just on its own in solution. All right. Pretty good timing for a Regents-Case test.